poured their fear and scorn over them. "You are filling our children's playgrounds with used syringes in an attempt to hurt them," they'd say. Bud explained they were happy to solve this problem. He arranged a regular patrol of addicts to go and clear away the needles. People were nonplussed. "Are they trying to mess with our heads? Is this a trick?" The addicts started to insist on being at every meeting where drug policy was discussed. They took a slogan from the movements of psychiatric patients who were fighting to be treated decently. "Nothing about us without us." Their message was, "We're here. We're human. We're alive. Don't talk about us as if we are nothing." They began, haltingly, to find a new language to talk about themselves as addicts. "We have certain inalienable rights. To stay alive, to stay healthy, to be treated as people. You are taking those rights away from us. We will claim them back." The mayor of Vancouver was a right-winger named Philip Owen, a rich businessman with sharp suits and sharper solutions. He knew how to deal with this problem. "Round up all the addicts," he said, "and lock them away at the army base at Chilliwack." He dismissed calls for the supervised injection rooms and the evidence that they had hugely reduced the overdose and AIDS transmission rates in Frankfurt, declaring, "I am totally and violently opposed." His solution was 25 years mandatory life sentence for anyone selling drugs. Bango, just like that. Just like that. Throw away the key. This attitude ran right through Vancouver. A senior member of the Vancouver Police Department dismissed addicts as vampires and werewolves. When a serial killer started to murder the mainly addicted sex workers of the downtown East Side, the police did virtually nothing for years, effectively allowing him to continue. One policewoman explained to the subsequent inquiry that the attitude among her fellow officers toward these addicts was that they wouldn't piss on them if they were on fire. Bud went on radio shows, and callers told him, "The only good junkie is a dead junkie." One asked, "Why don't they just string barbed wire around the downtown East Side and let them inject each other to death?" In the middle of all this, a killer whale named Finnan died in the Vancouver Aquarium, and there was an outburst of Princess Diana-style grief in the city. The deaths of more than 1,000 addicts, by contrast, were stirring no response. Bud believed that it would take a dramatic gesture to jolt the city into seeing his neighborhood differently, so the group he and his friends had formed, now christened the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, or VANDU, headed to Oppenheimer Park, one of the great green spaces of the city, and VANDU volunteers, along with the staff of the Portland Hotel Society, filled it with 1,000 plain wooden crosses. Each cross represented a drug user who had died on the downtown East Side in the past 4 years. Their names were written on the crosses in black marker. As the crosses stretched across the neat lawns of Oppenheimer Park, it looked like the graves of the First World War, a great swath of lost love. Bud and his friends sealed off the surrounding streets with wire and hung a vast banner that declared that these blocks were killing fields. They handed out leaflets explaining that overdose was the single biggest cause of death at that time in British Columbia for people between the ages of 30 and 49. The traffic stopped, and the streets were still, as if these deaths mattered, as if the loss of 1,000 addicts deserved a pause. Gandhi said, "One of the crucial roles for anyone who wants to change anything is to make the oppression visible, to give it a physical shape." Bud wrote a poem titled, 1,000 Crosses in Oppenheimer Park. It says, "A question each one of these 1,000 crosses puts to each of us, why are we still alive?" These activists believed that if people knew, if they could see the addicts as human, they would care. Anne Livingston, Bud's girlfriend at the time of the protests, tells me, "They were working on the belief that Canadians are decent people, and they don't know what's happening to us, and they need to know." Addicts had been persecuted by Prohibition since 1914, and none of them had fought back before. It hadn't seemed possible. Bud wasn't only creating a rebellion, he was creating a language with which addicts could rebel. It happened in Vancouver, and nowhere else for a reason. In most cities in the world, if addicts came out in public and declared who they were and began to fight for their rights, they would risk being fired from their jobs, stripped of their welfare, and expelled from their homes. But the Portland Hotel Society, where Gabber and Liz Evans worked, had a policy of housing Vancouver's addicts and refusing to throw them out. These addicts, alone in the world, had safe ground on which to stand. Vandu built a coffin and started to carry it to every city hall meeting where drugs were discussed. On it, written in large letters, were the words, "Who will be the next overdose victim?" They forced the mayor, Philip Owen, to see it, and to see the cost of his policies. They carried a sign, with words echoing right from the start of the drug war, "Drug users are people, too." Since Henry Smith Williams was broken, anybody opposing the drug war had entered the debate in a defensive crouch. They had preemptively pleaded, "No, no, we are not in favor of drug use. No, no, we are not bad people. No, no, we are not like those dirty junkies." Vandu was different. For the first time, they were putting prohibitionists on the defensive. They were saying, "You are the people waging a war. Here are the people you are killing. What are they dying for? Tell us." For months, Vancouver's officialdom watched this movement puzzled and repelled. After a while, the local health board figured it might be able to muffle this force and prevent it from embarrassing them with its protests by getting Bud to sit on the board for Vancouver, a powerful body that monitors all the health spending in the city and has more resources at its disposal than City Hall. At one meeting, after Bud joined, a top health official for the province explained calmly that the AIDS rate, the biggest cause of death among Bud's friends and neighbors, would eventually reach a saturation point in the downtown east side and fall of its own accord, because the addicts would simply die out. Sitting there, carefully taking notes, Bud slowly realized what was being said. The authorities were nonchalantly declaring that he and his friends would all die, and then the problem would be over. Bud managed, after a lot of arguing and lobbying, to get some small funding for Vandu from the health board, over the protests of Mayor Owen, and the group's members voted for a detailed agenda. Their first demand was simple: establish a safe, monitored place where people could go to inject their drugs. That would mean they could live and not die. Across Vancouver, people were starting to look at the addicts in a different way. These people who had been lying and dying alone were now campaigning together, and often they seemed to have more dignity than the people screaming at them that they should just go away and kill themselves. Many people had believed what Bruce Alexander was taught by Batman and his dad, that addicts didn't care about their lives or about anything but their next fix. But here they were, organizing to defend themselves and each other. And the addicts were starting to look at themselves differently. Bud said, "People would work 60 hours a week at Vandu. To see people's faces and how they changed, they saw, 'I have worth, I have value. I'm able to help somebody else. I'm no longer just what they call me in the newspapers.'" And Bud discovered, as a side effect, something else. "If we're off demonstrating, We're having board meetings, deciding what to do, and thinking about what our next actions could be. How is so-and-so doing? How can we help so-and-so because he got busted again? All that's taking you away from just being totally fixed on, I gotta get a drug, I gotta get a drug, 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 drug. Ever since he was 5 years old, Bud had wanted to die. But now, faced with a barrage of abuse, saying people like him are better off dead, he was discovering something deep inside himself. The will to live. For the first time in his life, he felt as if he had a home, and a community, and people to fight for. Bud's story can be read as proof of Gabber's theories that childhood trauma creates addiction, but it can also be seen as proof of Bruce's theories. Back in Toledo, when he stopped taking heroin and drinking alcohol but was still in an empty cage, alone, he was chronically suicidal. Now his life was becoming like Rat Park, where he had friends and everything that gives life meaning. And he was finding his desire to use drugs ebbed. That's what I wanted, for my spirit to wake up. I didn't just want to stop drugs and feel like shit, feel even worse, Bud says. He wanted to be fully alive as a person, making a difference in the world. And now it was happening. Yet even as the most active members of Vandu were starting to feel better about themselves, people were still dying all around them. We had 25 board members, one of the co-founders, Dean Wilson, says, because you never knew who was going to be alive at the next meeting. When Bud came out of one health board assembly, he watched a man methodically going through the trash in an overflowing dumpster, and he saw empty syringe packages floating and a pink blouse in a heap. And there were still the sirens all the time. When you are confronted with historical forces that seem vastly bigger than you, like a war on your people that has lasted nearly 100 years, you have two choices. You can accept it as your fate and try to adjust to being a pinball being whacked around a table by the powerful, or you can band together with other people to become a historical force yourself, one that will eventually overwhelm the forces raged against you. Bud chose the second way. He appealed for more and more people to join Vandu. He studied in the library to find out what the official definition of a public health emergency is in Canada, and discovered that Vancouver had never declared one. He started maneuvering for the health board to formally do it, and under his pressure, they finally agreed. This was now, officially, the city's first emergency. Suddenly, Vandu was an international news story, and Bud was interviewed by everyone from the BBC to the New York Times. He wrote a poem explaining that the war on drugs is a war against hope and compassion and care. Now that they knew there were addicts at the meetings, and that helping them to survive was now an official duty, the city bureaucrats started to talk differently. It's hard to dismiss somebody's death as irrelevant if they are looking you in the face. Bud was able to persuade the health board to provide funding for Vandu, and they established a permanent center in the city, a big old storefront in the heart of the downtown east side. They voted to use their public money to fly in experts from Switzerland and the Netherlands to explain how those countries had massively reduced the death rate of addicts by abandoning the war on drugs. I travelled to Switzerland later to see how this worked. But still, the mayor, Philip Owen, was determined to block all progress. He actually declared a moratorium on all new projects to help addicts, in the middle of the emergency. Vandu co-founder, Dean Wilson, stood up at a city council meeting, looked him in the eye and said, "It almost seems like you are sentencing us to death. One addict a day is dying, and if one of you were dying every day you woke up and there was one less person working in City Hall, I can tell you that problem would be solved in 2 minutes." Owen stared on, pale, his face drawn, as if he couldn't understand how this was happening. Who are these people? Budd won the City Vancouver Book Award for a collection of his poetry. Normally the award is presented by the mayor, but Owen refused to do it. Budd was beginning to despair. He had fought so hard, but the mayor seemed to be an insurmountable barrier. But then, something nobody could have predicted happened. Embarrassed by this endless protest, Mayor Owen decided he had better find out who these addicts were and how they could be shut up. They were from a different world. He had been a businessman for 30 years and came from a privileged political dynasty in which his grandfather was the chief constable, and his father the lieutenant governor. He hadn't ever known any addicts, so he decided to walk around the downtown east side incognito and sit with the addicts and hear what they had to say. And this man, who had argued that they should all be rounded up and locked away on army bases, this local Anslinger, was amazed. When he described his memory of it in 2012, he still seemed startled by what he had witnessed. "The stories you hear," he said to me, "blow you away." These people, he found, had had such hard lives. He remembered a 15-year-old girl on the streets and shook his head. "They're not malicious," he came to see. "They're not bad. They're just broken." So he arranged an afternoon tea party for the most hardcore addicts and sat and listened to them talk about their lives for hours. "The stories were just unbelievable," Owen repeated, shaking his head again. Now that the addicts were no longer phantasmagorical bogeymen, but actual people with real stories, Owen realized he would have to learn more. He met with Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who was the Pope of the neoliberal right, and a leading critic of the drug war. Friedman had grown up under alcohol prohibition in Chicago, where he concluded that prohibition causes more problems than the drug itself. The drug war, he believed, was the ultimate big government program, a criminal waste of money. Owen, who had always been a fiscal conservative, started to look at the cost of the drug war and said to his fellow conservatives, "You want to balance the budget and get our fiscal health in shape? Let's get realistic." Mayor Owen knew that politicians were supposed to ignore the facts he had learned and keep pledging endless warfare. But he said, "I just get so sick and tired of bullshit." He decided he was going to change the way he conducted his public meetings and press conferences about drugs. From now on, sitting on the platform with him, he had the chief of police to answer questions about crime, the medical officers to answer questions about health, and an addict from Vandu to answer questions about drug use and addiction. The mayor admitted he knew nothing about it. Why not have an addict there to provide a first-hand answer? With addicts by his side, he pledged to open the first safe injecting room in North America to keep his new friends in Vandu alive, as the start of a wave of policies to protect addicts. "Just think about it," he implored his fellow politicians. "Think about the country. Leave politics at the door." The more the mayor looked and learned, the more he came to believe the prohibitionist policies were rotten right through. "Let's start by legalizing marijuana, taxing it, and putting it under the control of the federal government. It's not rocket science. It's a fairly simple proposal, and it works," he said to me. "Let's start with marijuana. We're not talking about cocaine and heroin, although I hope we get there eventually. You've got to crawl before you can walk. Then we'll come to the others and gradually go through the process. The evidence is in. The facts are in." Other politicians told him he was mad, not because of the substance of his policies, but because of the politics. People said, "You're going to get defeated, mucking around with a bunch of no-goods," Owen tells me. In fact, he was re-elected at the next two mayoral elections in landslide victories. When he and I met in a café on the downtown east side, people interrupted us spontaneously to thank him for what he had done. But for his Conservative Party, it was all too much. They eventually deselected him for the next mayoral race in favour of a more prohibitionist candidate, who lost. His successor as mayor, Larry Campbell, was a strong supporter of the injection site, now named Insight. I walk there, past Oppenheimer Park, where the crosses once spiked through the grass, and I find that on the inside it looks rather like a hairdresser's. As you enter, you are taken through the lobby, shown to your booth, and given clean needles. You inject yourself, while a friendly, trained nurse waits unobtrusively in the background. The booths are small and neat and lit from above. Once you've injected yourself, you can walk through to get medical treatment or counselling, or just talk about your problems. Any time you are ready to stop, there is a detox centre right upstairs with a warm bed waiting for you. Because of the uprising by Vandu, and a Conservative mayor who listened to the facts, opened his heart and changed his mind, Vancouver now has the most progressive drug policies on the North American continent. But many people had understandable fears about this experiment. Wouldn't it open the floodgates to even more drug use, and therefore end up with more death, not less? It seemed like common sense. The local business owner, Price Vassage, reflected the opinion of many people when he warned at the time, "People say drug injection sites are going to save lives because there's all these deaths from drug injections." Bullshit! People die of drug overdoses because they do drugs. If you encourage them to continue to use drugs, there's a greater chance they will have a drug overdose. In 2012, the results of a decade of changed policies came in. The average life expectancy on the downtown east side, according to the city's medical health officials, had risen by 10 years. One newspaper headline said simply, "Life expectancy jump astounds." The Province newspaper explained, "Medical health officer Dr. John Carsley said it is rare to see such a shift in a population's life expectancy." Some of this improvement is due to the fact that the neighborhood is no longer seen as a disaster zone, so some wealthier, healthier people have started to move in. But the Globe and Mail newspaper reported, using figures from the British Columbia Coroner's Office, that drug-related fatalities were down by 80% in this period. To find a rise in life expectancy this drastic, you'd have to look to the end of wars, which is what this is. Philip Owen smiled at me in his expensive suit and said he was proud to have sacrificed his political career in this cause. In 2012, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that drug addicts have a right to life, and that safe injecting rooms are an inherent part of that right and can never be legally shut down. There is no need to fill Oppenheimer Park with crosses today. The killing fields have emptied, and the addicts did it for themselves. Throughout 2013, Bud kept getting sick. He had a lot of pain in his back, the legacy of his time on the streets, he believed. And finally, in May 2014, he was taken to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with pneumonia. They released him early. The next day, he was found dead in his apartment. He was 66 years old. For his memorial service, the streets of the downtown east side were shut down and sealed off, just as they had been on the day they laid 1,000 crosses in Oppenheimer Park. Everyone, from homeless street addicts to a member of parliament, read his poems aloud, and Vandu marched through the streets in a parade. There were many people in that crowd who knew they were alive because of the uprising Bud had begun all those years before. Bud lived long enough to see something he feared he would never witness. Back when he was at his lowest ebb of his addiction, It was the poetry of Rimbaud that kept him alive. He vowed then, he told me, to write one poem like that for another human being, to really connect deeply in their pain and their suffering, in the same way these poets did with me. A few years before he died, Bud went on a reading tour of high schools in British Columbia, and way up north in a town called Smithers, he read out a poem titled When I Was 15, about the time he had tried to kill himself. He didn't impose any retrospective wisdom. He tried only to describe truthfully what it had been like for him on that day. He didn't know it yet, but there was a girl in the audience who, a few days before, had taken an overdose, and her parents had responded by telling her she couldn't be unhappy because they gave her everything. Her teacher suggested she come to the poetry reading to take her mind off things. At the end of the reading, the girl approached Bud. She insisted that the teacher unlock the office and run off a photocopy of the poem. She wasn't leaving without it, she said. She clutched it as she left, glowing now. And Bud thought to himself, I stayed alive long enough to keep my promise. I wrote my poem. Chapter 15 Snowfall and Strengthening. After a year and a half of meeting victims of this war, and feeling more and more angry and depressed, Vancouver had given me an itchy sense of hope. I had learned from Bud that things could get dramatically better if people organized and demanded it, and I wanted to see more experiments and innovations like this, to discover whether this was a freak result or a harbinger of how things could be. But as I asked around, it slowly became clear to me that there were almost no positive experiments taking place in the Americas. A few prisons in the United States have slightly more generous addiction treatment programs. A few state governments have tiny programs giving out weaker substitute drugs to the most extreme addicts. That, it seemed, was it. But I knew that the two European countries I am a citizen of, Britain and Switzerland, had experimented with much more substantial alternatives. It was time, I realized, to come home. I had a vague memory, learned, I think, from reading Mike Gray's book Drug Crazy, years ago, that in the early 1990s, in the north of England, there had been an experiment in prescribing heroin, but I knew very little about it. I tracked down the man who had led this experiment, and it turned out he was in exile, in New Zealand. I interviewed him by phone, and then travelled to Liverpool to find everyone I could who had witnessed what happened there. The story they told me had, I quickly realized, startling echoes of where the story of the drug war had begun, long ago. 44 years and 5,000 miles from the shuttering of the last heroin clinics in California, a man named John Marks walked into a grey little doctor's office in a stretch of the Wirral, in the drizzly north of England, where they used to build ships and now built nothing. It was his first day as a psychiatrist there. John was a big, bearded Welshman from the valleys, swathed in smoke from the pipe he puffed on, and with the murk of the River Mersey washing past, he was not optimistic. Like Henry Smith Williams, he was the intellectual son of a doctor, and like him, he thought he frankly had better things to do than waste his energies on addicts in a place like this. John had come here to crack the mystery of schizophrenia and how it really works, but because he was the new boy, he was given a chore. His colleague said to him, "You can have all the addicts, John, all the alcoholics and drug addicts." John knew that there would be plenty of addicts waiting for him, because Merseyside in the 1980s was the site of the most charged class wars in British history. Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government had pledged to kick the north of England off what they saw as subsidy-sucking nationalised industries, and her ministers were privately proposing to abandon Liverpool, saying that reviving its economy would be like trying to make water flow uphill. The people of Merseyside saw their workplaces shuttered, their houses become dilapidated, and their streets set on fire, as riots began to rip through the inner cities. Now, heroin was spreading in the wake of the flames. John could see that the hopelessness sinking over the region would breed even more addiction, and he sighed. Every Thursday, a slew of addicts came into the clinic, and it was John's job to write them prescriptions for heroin. They sat down. They answered a few questions. Then they were given enough heroin to last them until the following Thursday. And that was it. At first, John was bemused, thinking this a bizarre idea. Free heroin for addicts. He had unwittingly inherited the last crease in the legal global drug supply system that Harry Anslinger had never been able to iron out. Before my journey home, I believed Britain's war on drugs had been like most of our foreign policy, a cry of, "Me too!" in a bad American accent. We jail huge numbers of people, but a little less than the United States. We back the drug wars abroad, but not quite so intensely. It turns out I was a little right and a little wrong. There is one significant area in which we are worse. Black men are 10 times more likely to be imprisoned for drug offences than white men in Britain, a figure beating both the United States and apartheid South Africa. This is partly because, just as in the United States, our drug war began in a race panic. As the book Dope Girls by Marek Cohen explains, on the 27th of October, 1918, a young white showgirl called Billy Carlton stayed up until 5 in the morning with her friends in her flat behind the Savoy Hotel, with a large amount of cocaine in front of her. She was found dead later that day. There was a press furore about how two sinister forces were bringing these chemicals into the British Isles. The sickening crowd of undersized aliens, who made up the wave of Chinese immigrants, and the nigger musicians playing jazz. They put quotation marks around the word musician, not around the word nigger. Drugs were banned to save the country from these racial poisons. After the ban, the News of the World reported, with relief, "Evil Negro caught," and added, "The sacrifice of the souls of white women would finally stop." And it was all cheered on by the US government, delighted to see that other nations shared its concerns. But for a long time, there was one loophole. Back when the United States was ordering its doctors to block up all legal supplies of heroin and breaking Henry Smith Williams' brother, doctors in Britain flatly refused to fall into line. They said addicts were ill, and that it was immoral to leave them to suffer or die. The British government, unsure of how to proceed, appointed a man called Sir Humphrey Rolleston, a baronet and president of the Royal College of Physicians, to decide what our policy should be. After taking a great deal of evidence, he became convinced that the doctors were right. "Relapse," he found, "sooner or later appears to be the rule, and permanent cure the exception." So he insisted that doctors be left the leeway to prescribe heroin or not, as they saw fit. And so for 2 generations, Henry Smith Williams' policies prevailed in Britain, and nowhere else on earth. The result was that while heroin addiction was swelling into the hundreds of thousands in the United States, the picture in Britain was different. The number of addicts never exceeded 1,000, and, as Mike Gray explains, the addict population in Britain remained pretty much as it was. Little old ladies, self-medicating doctors, chronic pain sufferers, ne'er-do-wells, all middle-aged people, most of them leading otherwise normal lives. British doctors insisted there was such a thing as a stabilized addict, and they said that when you prescribe, this was the norm rather than the exception. When Billie Holiday came to London in the 1950s, she was amazed. They are civilized about it, and they have no narcotics problem at all, she explained. One day America is going to smarten up and do the same thing. Whenever Anslinger was challenged about this evidence in public, he simply denied the British system existed. His evidence was that they didn't have it in Hong Kong, which he said is a British city. In private, however, he worked hard to shut down the British system. In 1956, the British Health Secretary told the House of Commons that, under pressure from the United States, he was going to have to cut off the manufacture of heroin. British doctors were outraged, explaining that the National Health Service exists for the benefit of the sick and suffering citizen. They would not back down, and Anslinger couldn't crush them the way he did his own country's doctors, and so the policy stayed. But then, in the 1960s, this system was suddenly ruptured. The British government announced that there had been a catastrophic increase in the number of heroin addicts, because it had gone up from 927 to 2,782. This appeared to be happening for two reasons. The swinging 60s were changing attitudes across the world, prompting more drug experimentation, and it turned out that in London, specifically, a handful of doctors in the West End had been effectively selling heroin prescriptions to recreational users. So the British government moved closer to the American model, but not all the way. The power to prescribe heroin was kept, but it was restricted to a small cadre of psychiatrists. That's hardly unreasonable, John thought, as he surveyed the addicts who came into his clinic. They were maybe a few dozen lads, the occasional girl who came and got their pot of junk, workers, bargemen, all walks of life, really. He told them to stop using, and they argued back, telling him they needed it. He decided after a few years to shut the program down so he could move on to exploring schizophrenia and manic depression, and genuinely interesting conditions. I found this a bit of a headache, he said to me. I had bigger fish to fry. But as he prepared to do this, there was a directive from Margaret Thatcher's government, inspired by her friend Ronald Reagan's intensified drug war across the Atlantic. Every part of Britain had to show it had an anti-drug strategy, it said, and conduct a cost-benefit analysis to show what worked. So John commissioned the academic Dr. Russell Newcomb to look into it. He assumed Newcomb would come back and say these patients were like heroin addicts in the United States, and like heroin addicts everywhere, at least in the cliché, unemployed and unemployable, criminal with high levels of HIV and a high death rate. Except the research found something very different. Newcomb found that none of these addicts had the HIV virus, even though Liverpool was a port city where you would expect it to be rife. Indeed, none of them had the usual problems found among addicts, overdoses, abscesses, disease. They mostly had regular jobs and normal lives. After receiving this report, John looked again at these patients. There was a man named Sidney, who was an old Liverpool docker, happily married, lovely couple of kids, John recalled. He'd been chugging along on his heroin for a couple of decades. He seemed to be living a decent, healthy life. So, in fact, now that John thought of it, did all the people prescribed heroin in his clinic. But how could this be? Doesn't heroin inherently damage the body? Doesn't it naturally cause abscesses, diseases, and death? All doctors agree that medically pure heroin, injected using clean needles, does not produce these problems. Under Prohibition, criminals cut their drugs with whatever similar-looking powders they can find, so they can sell more batches and make more cash. Alan Perry, who worked for the local health authority, saw that patients who didn't have a prescription were injecting smack with brick dust in it, coffee, crushed bleach crystals, anything. He explained to journalists at the time, "Now you inject cement into your veins, and you don't have to be a medical expert to work out that's going to cause harm." You could immediately see the difference between the street addicts stumbling into the clinic for help for the first time and the patients who had been on legal prescriptions for a while. The street addicts would often stagger in with abscesses that looked like hard-boiled eggs rotting under their skin, and with open wounds on their hands and legs that looked, as Perry recalls, like a pizza of infection. It's mushy, and the cheese you get on it is pus, and it just gets bigger and bigger. A combination of contaminated drugs and dirty needles had given a home to these infections in the addict's flesh, and they can go right through the bone and out the other side, so you've got a hole going right through you. You have that on both legs, and your body's not strong enough. It'll cut right through. You had situations where people were walking and their legs snapped. They often looked like survivors of a war, with amputated limbs and flesh that looked charred and scarred. The addicts on prescription, by contrast, looked like the nurses or the receptionists, or John himself. You couldn't tell them apart. Harry Anslinger thought this contamination of drugs was a good thing because it would discourage people from using. By 1942, he was boasting, "The addict is now using heroin, which is over 99% adulterated." But Alan Perry saw the effects in this clinic. "These shitty drugs, when you try to inject them, they block up your veins, and they really make a mess of you," he tells me. "The trouble is, with dirty heroin, one vein more or less goes with one hit. Then, if you damage that vein, you'll try another. And eventually, you work your way around your body, looking at what veins you've got, and sticking stuff in them. Destroying your body as you go." Faced with this evidence, John Marks was beginning to believe that many of the harms of drugs are to do with laws around them, not the drugs themselves. In the clinic, they started to call the infections and abscesses and amputations drug war wounds. So he slowly got, he told me, that this clinic was working wonders by bypassing criminality and providing safer forms of the drug. John began to wonder, if prescription is so effective, why don't we do it more? If it is preventing people from getting HIV and injecting poisons into their veins and dying in the gutters, why not expand it? He decided to embark on an experiment. He expanded his heroin prescription program from a dozen people to more than 400. And with a local pharmacist, he pioneered the prescription of heroin reefers, cigarettes soaked in heroin. He also prescribed cocaine, including smokable cocaine, for a small number of people who had become addicted to street crack. He knew that, like alcohol, cocaine is harmful to your health over time, but he explained, "If you were an alcoholic in the Chicago of the 1930s, and had just stolen your grandmother's purse to buy a tot of adulterated methylated spirits at an exorbitant price from Mr. Capone, I would have a clean conscience in prescribing you a dram of the best Scotch whiskey." The first people to notice an effect were the local police. Inspector Michael Lofts studied 142 heroin and cocaine addicts in the area, and he found that in the 18 months before getting a prescription from Dr. Marks, they received, on average, 6.88 criminal convictions, mostly for theft and robbery. In the 18 months afterward, that figure fell to an average of 0.44 criminal convictions. In other words, there was a 93% drop in theft and burglary. You could see them transform in front of your own eyes, Lofts told a newspaper, amazed. They came in outrageous condition, stealing daily to pay for illegal drugs, and became, most of them, very amiable, reasonable, law-abiding people. It was just as Henry Smith Williams had said all those years before. One day, a young mother named Julia Scott came into his clinic and explained she had ended up working as a prostitute to support her habit. Confronted with patients like this, John told an interviewer, he was starting to feel anger. It makes me furious that a group of young, able people should suffer from the same death rate as people with smallpox, between 10% and 20%. I'm not a bleeding heart, and I don't think there's anything glamorous about drugs. I try to make my clients realize that what they are doing is boring, boring, boring. He wanted Julia to be bored, not terrified and in danger, so he wrote her a prescription. I stopped straight away, she said later to Ed Brantley of CBS's 60 Minutes, when they came to report on the Liverpool experiment. I went back once just to see, and I was almost physically sick just to see these girls doing what I used to do. Now she was working as a waitress and able to be a mother to a little girl. As Julia pushed her daughter on a swing, Bradley asked her, Without that prescription, where do you think you'd be today? I'd probably be dead by now, she said. I need heroin to live. The changes taking place as John Marks expanded his prescription program weren't limited to his patients. On the streets of the neighborhood, the drug gangs started to recede. John overstated it at the time when he said drug dealing had been totally wiped out. The writer, Will Self, reporting on the ground, asked around and learned that there were still dealers to be found. But the police said there were far fewer than before. Inspector Lofts explained at the time, Since the clinics opened, the street heroin dealer has slowly but surely abandoned the streets of Warrington and Widnes. It was as if time was running backward, to the era before the drug war. In a small brick building by the River Mersey, a California dream was being reborn. But John Marks differed from Henry Smith Williams in one important way. Henry thought that drug addicts would need to be given their prescription for the rest of their lives. That was the part of his story that most disconcerted me. It seemed that the only alternative to the drug war forever was being prescribed a drug forever. But since then, a discovery had been made about addiction, one that Henry Smith Williams couldn't have foreseen. It was first spotted by a psychologist named Charles Winnick, who set up a free clinic for addicted musicians in New York in the 1950s. Winnick, like everyone else, used to believe that once you were a heroin addict, you were a heroin addict until you died. But what he found was something very different. Heroin use was concentrated in the 25 to 39 group, after which it tapered to very little, he wrote. Most addicts simply stopped of their own accord. They mature out of addiction, possibly because the stresses and strains of life are becoming stabilized for them, and because the major challenges of adulthood have passed. This process, the fancy names for it are maturing out or natural recovery, is not the exception. It's what happens to almost all of the addicts around you. This finding is so striking, I had to read about it in slews of studies before I really took it on board. Most addicts will simply stop, whether they are given treatment or not, provided prohibition doesn't kill them first. They usually do so after around 10 years of use. So once John Marks knew this, he came to believe his job was a matter of keeping them alive long enough to recover naturally. That's why, every week, the addicts of Widnes turned up at John's office for a meeting and left with a prescription for smokable heroin or, in a small number of cases, as we will see shortly, cocaine. John explained to the public, "If they're drug takers determined to continue their drug use, the choice that I'm being offered, and society is being offered, is drugs from the clinic or drugs from the mafia." There was one obvious reason why people were worried by John's experiment. There is no punishment if you give people drugs for free. Surely they will use them more. This was one of Harry Anslinger's most reasonable objections. If you introduce prescription, he warned, drug addicts would multiply unrestrained. It seems like common sense. But John, by contrast, thought the rate of use would hold steady. If being ostracized by your family, riven with disease and plunged into poverty didn't affect your decision to use, how would a few free heroin reefers make a difference? It turns out both sides were wrong. Drug use didn't rise, and it didn't hold steady. It actually fell, including among the people who weren't being given a prescription. Research published in the Proceedings of the Royal College of the Physicians of Edinburgh compared Widnes, which had a heroin clinic, to the very similar Liverpool borough of Bootle, which didn't. In Bootle, there were 207.54 drug users per 100,000 people. In Widnes, it was just 15.83, a 12-fold decrease. But why? Why would prescribing heroin to addicts mean that fewer people became addicts? Dr. Russell Newcombe, working out of John Mark's clinic, discovered what he believes is the explanation. Imagine you are a street heroin addict. You have to raise a large sum of money every day for your habit, £100 a day for heroin at that time in the Wirral. How are you going to get it? You can rob. You can prostitute, but there is another way, and it's a lot less unpleasant than either of them. You can buy your drugs, take what you need, and then cut the rest with talcum powder and sell it to other people. But to do that, you need to persuade someone else to take the drugs too. You need to become a salesman, promoting the experience. So heroin, under prohibition, becomes, in effect, a pyramid selling scheme. Insurance companies would love to have salesmen like drug addicts, with that level of motivation, John remarked. Here's why drug use went into reverse in John Mark's clinic. Prescription, it turns out, kills the pyramid selling scheme by stripping out the profit motive. You don't have to sell smack to get smack. This explains why, when you prescribe heroin, fewer people are recruited to use heroin, and why, when you prescribe cocaine, fewer people are recruited to use cocaine. As Russell Newcombe tells me this, I can't help but think of a weird little twist of history. Harry Anslinger always said drug addiction was infectious. It isn't in normal circumstances, but the system of prohibition he built makes it so, after all. John Marx was being shouted at. The public meeting was getting nasty, and he was being abused. But it wasn't a right-winger or conservative yelling at him. At this time, Liverpool was run by a communist group called Militant Tendency, who believed in establishing an immediate socialist revolution in Britain. John Marx, they declared, was preventing that revolution by tranquilizing the working classes with heroin. The opiates of the masses turned out to be opiates, literally. Marx was blocking Marx. The father of one of John's patients stood up and addressed the crowd. "I was a bit puzzled by John giving Jimmy heroin to start with," he said, "because I thought the job was to get him off. But you know what? Since he started with this Dr. Marx, we now see him at mealtimes. He sits with us and talks with us. He's even back with his girlfriend. And you know what, lads? He's got an offer of a job next week." John Marx expected that the news of these results would spur people across the country and across the world to do the same. Who would turn down a policy that saves the lives of drug users and leads to less drug use and causes dealers to gradually disperse? At last, this ripple effect seemed to have begun. He was asked to set up a bigger version of the Witness Clinic at the Metropolitan Centre in Liverpool, and then it was decided that every health district in the region, from Southport in the north to Macclesfield in the east, would have a prescribing clinic of its own. There was a drop in shoplifting so massive that the department store chain Marks & Spencer's publicly praised the policy and decided to sponsor the first world conference on harm reduction and drug taking in Liverpool in 1990. There, one of the police officers inspired by John's experiment, Derek O'Connell, explained, "As police officers, part of our oath of office is to protect life. Clearly, we must reach injectors and get them the help that they require. But in the meantime, we must try and keep them healthy, for we are their police as well." But John was about to whack into the same wall as Henry Smith Williams. With a few of his colleagues, John was invited to tour the United States to explain how his policy could save American lives. Everywhere they went, at the end of the meeting, they were told the same thing, that the Republican congressman, Jesse Helms, had been pressuring the organizers to shut them down and shut them up. Helms didn't want anybody to interfere with the war on drugs. A few years later, on a CNN phone-in show, a caller thanked him for everything you've done to help keep down the niggers. And he replied by saluting the camera and saying, "Well, thank you, I think." After an item about John's clinic was broadcast on one of the top-rated news shows in the United States, 60 Minutes, in 1991, John was phoned by Bing Spear, the chief inspector of the drugs branch of the Home Office. "We've got a lot of heat from our embassy in Washington," he warned. "They've got onto the government saying, 'What's this about somebody in Liverpool giving out crack cocaine? Close it down immediately.'" The conservative government decided to merge John's clinic with a new health trust, run by evangelical Christians who opposed prescription on principle. The patients panicked, because they knew what being cut off would mean, a return to abscesses and overdoses and scrambling for drugs from gangsters. John was powerless to help them. The results came quickly. In all the time Dr. Marks had been prescribing, from 1992 to 1995, he never had a drug-related death among his patients. Now, Sydney, the Liverpool docker, went back to buying adulterated crap on the streets, and died. Julia Scott, who said she would be dead without her prescription, was proved right. She died of an overdose, leaving her daughter without a mother. Of the 450 patients Marks prescribed to, 20 were dead within 6 months, and 41 were dead within 2 years. More lost limbs and caught potentially lethal diseases. They returned to the death rate for addicts under prohibition, 10 to 20%, similar to smallpox. Dr. Russell Newcomb, who had worked in the clinic, tells me the survivors were immediately forced back onto the street. People who had jobs lost them. It split relationships up. People rapidly went back to debt and crime. The average person thrown off John Mark's prescription regime would have been back in acquisitive crime within a month. Whenever he'd see one of them in the street, he'd ask them what they were doing now. "Grafting," they'd say. The local word for stealing to support your habit. Today, Merseyside is riddled with drug addiction, and drug gangs are killing each other in the war for drugs. John found he was blacklisted within his own country. He ended up literally at the other end of the earth, in Gisborne, the farthest corner of New Zealand, the place from which he told me his side of the story by telephone in 2012. "I was exiled," John Marks told me. One day, the Royal Astronomical Society asked him to play Galileo at an open day. He had to play-act being burned at the stake. His voice softened at the irony. But when I said to him, "This story